Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and a warm welcome to the Friday Five, my weekly chat from the world of well-being with some news, some views, and this week, a very insightful and emotional insight into the life of a cancer patient who also just happens to be a media doctor. She recently diarised her own experience having been treated for colon cancer. Do please make sure you have a box of tissues at the ready, as it is a very heartfelt and raw discussion, more of which in a moment. But first, a bit of news about some distinctly dodgy dealings in the world of food supplements. And as regular listeners will know, I am a fan of many a food supplement, especially some of the newer and more advanced nutrients designed to help us live well for longer, such as NMN and glutathione and the like. And many of these are pretty pricey. Well, several of the brands that I've recommended in the past also use innovative delivery systems such as liposomal technology. Now, liposomes are something that have been around in the beauty world for decades. I remember first writing about them, 30 or more years ago as a junior beauty editor. And they're a very interesting way of transporting an ingredient into the skin, or in the case of a food supplement, into the body. Well, under the microscope, liposomes look like tiny, tiny bubbles. They're made of a fatty membrane and then filled with whatever needs transporting into our cells. In the case of supplements, they are most often filled with ingredients such as vitamin C or glutathione, to name just two. And because they bypass the gut, they are absorbed directly into the body's cells, making them a far more effective and powerful way of taking your vitamins. But liposomal supplements are expensive. And like so many areas of food supplementation, this is open to fraudulent activity and misinformation unless buying from reputable brands. Well, this week has seen the release of details surrounding some legal action brought by Altrient, makers of several excellent liposomal supplements, who took various supplement brands to task for claiming their products contained liposomes. Well, in fact, they had been independently tested and found to either have low or in some cases no liposomal content. Well, on the basis of this, Altrient made a complaint to the ASA, who ruled that those who falsely market their products as liposomal must remove their liposomal claims for the benefit of consumers. So that is good news for all of us. And you may remember that I did a podcast a while back on vitamin C with Dr. Thomas Levy in America. He's a cardiologist, vitamin C expert, and also a consultant for Live On Labs, who make many of these liposomal supplements. And he says, quote, "This is an important day for the liposomal vitamin industry and for consumers. Liposomal supplements are a fascinating technology for delivering maximized absorption. But, quote, buyer beware, there is more fraud in liposomal supplements than in any other type of supplement I have seen." That says Dr. Thomas Levy. So there you go. Well, if you're concerned about any liposomal products that you may have bought and spent a lot of money on, do check out the scientific research on the brand's own websites. And you can also do your own little at-home test, because liposomes do not dissolve in water. So if you mix the supplement in a small glass of water, you should find that it doesn't dissolve, but it stays in some kind of semi-gel-like state. Well, the two brands that I buy from, and I use liposomal vitamin C and glutathione, are from Altrient, and I buy via their Abundance and Health website here in the UK. And I also buy from Youth and Earth, direct from their website. And yes, I know both brands are a bit more expensive, but I feel reassured that I am getting the real deal, which ultimately obviously is the best value when compared to shelling out on something that doesn't actually work. And both websites do give my wellbeing community here a generous Liz Loves discount if used at their checkout. So that is Liz Loves, all in capitals, all in one word, on both the Abundance and Health and the Youth and Earth websites. You can head over to my website, lizarwellbeing.com, and look up Liz Loves if you would like more information on that. And actually, the glutathione supplement that I buy from Youth and Earth is a mango-flavoured glutathione liquid. That's the one that I take, and it's the one that I most often give to my children because it really does go a long way to disguise the, well, sulphurous and frankly pretty rank taste of pure glutathione on its own. Now, I mentioned earlier that you might need to have a box of tissues or at least a hanky at the ready for my guest this week as I chat to the GP and best-selling author, Dr. Philippa Kay, a doctor with a particular interest in children's, women's and sexual health. And in fact, she's written multiple books in these areas, including The M Word, Everything You Need to Know About Menopause, a topic, obviously, as you know, is very close to my heart. Well, Philippa's life changed in May 2019. When out of the blue, at the age of 39, she was diagnosed with bowel cancer. Now cancer-free, Philippa has detailed her journey in her latest book, Doctors Get Cancer Too, a frank diary which explores just how it feels to be a cancer patient after a long career of being on the other side of the desk. Well, welcome, Philippa. It's really a great privilege and pleasure to talk to you because you've just got so much knowledge as a GP, a medic specialising in children's health, women's health, sexual health. And I just know it's going to be a great chat. So welcome to my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I think I first came across you when you wrote The M Word, Everything You Need to Know About Menopause. When did you put that one together?
So that came out in, the years go by, don't they? That came out in February 2020. So I wrote that in about 2019 on the back of my surgery being full of women in their 40s who were stopping driving because they were so anxious in the car, who thought they had dementia. That's what they were coming in to check for. And there was it was really clear to me that there was a real need for so much more information about menopause to be out there.
Absolutely. And presumably you've been delighted to see how that landscape has changed a little bit.
Certainly. Absolutely. So it feels like the shouting from the rooftops is beginning to be heard. There is a long way to go here. And we are fighting, you know, decades, if not millennia, of a paternalistic society and women's health shame and stigma. But it feels like maybe the tide is beginning to shift a little bit.
Oh, my gosh, let's hope so. Have you read Unwell Women by Eleanor Cleghorn that's just come out?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my goodness. Terrifying. You would love it, but it's terrifying and awful and shocking in equal measures. But I'm interested to know, but before we move on to talk about your latest book, which is a completely different topic and one which I know we're going to find completely fascinating too. Are you seeing a difference as a GP in your surgeries or with online consultations? What's the narrative now for midlife women coming in with menopausal symptoms?
So I think it depends exactly sort of where you are and where you work and the socioeconomic and cultural demographics and all of that. Because, yes, there has been a push on mainstream media, but not everybody is aware of mainstream media. And there's also beginning to be a push in secondary schools, and secondary school, essentially teenagers, are informing their parents. And so I'm beginning to see a little bit of that. My daughter says, you know, X, Y, Z, what do you think? But there is still very clearly an idea that menopause is flushes and sweats only, which obviously isn't true. And the conversations that I have day in, day out about HRT, big bad wolf versus panacea. These are still daily conversations. And I think there is a long way to go, but I think that I'm beginning to see women coming forward saying help. As opposed to before, women were coming forward saying help for something else entirely, and then we were connecting the dots. More women, I think, are coming forward saying, help, I shouldn't have to put up with this. Yes. But we shall see.
Yeah, there's just been some great work. I was actually looking at Dr. Louise Newson. I was looking at her Instagram this week, and she's talking about HRT, saying, and I quote here, HRT today still carries a very negative stigma that it can cause breast cancer. However, there are no studies showing that any type of HRT is associated with a statistically significant increased risk of developing breast cancer. In addition, there are many benefits from taking HRT.
Absolutely. And I think that there are some things that we've sort of always been told. There are some things which you perceive as a truth, whether or not it's a truth, you know. Yeah. So, for example, when I started medicine, there was definitely an idea amongst my patients that if you hadn't had a baby, you couldn't have a coil. Really? And that it seemed like everybody's mothers or grandmothers had this idea, and that had been passed down, and so it hadn't even occurred to people that they could if they hadn't had children or didn't want children or whatever, and so you were sort of fighting against something that people definitely perceived to be true, and so you have to work harder to get there as opposed to starting from a neutral stance. And I think that's very true about HRT. And so the way I always start my conversations is, there are lots of options available, not all of them involve hormone, but in order to make the decision about what's right for you, we need to talk about all of them, and that includes HRT. And then there, people tend to be a little bit more open to hearing the conversation, and then once they've heard, they can then make their choices.
Brilliant. Now, obviously, in that post I read from Dr. Newson, she talks about breast cancer, and that's cancer is in fact the main subject of our conversation today, because your latest book, Doctors Get Cancer Too, is an extraordinary book. I mean, it's a really frank diary written from the perspective of a cancer patient rather than a cancer doctor. Why did you decide to write the book, and what was your journey really with that?
I didn't decide to write it at all. No. That's true. I did not decide to write a book about having cancer. I could not stop the words coming out. I have always found writing to be rather therapeutic, and people always said to me, you know, you were a junior doctor when you started writing books. How did you have the time? How do you have the time now? I was like, but that's what I do all day, is I sort of convert medicalese into English. And so to do that with my knowledge is something that sort of flows for me, and I find it quite relaxing. And when it came to having, and I hadn't written a diary since I was a little girl, in a sort of padlock way of, you know, mum made three peas. But when I was diagnosed with cancer, I did not know what to do with the thoughts in my head. And there were lots of them, and they were very complicated and conflicting. And so I dumped them. And I dumped them every single day, sometimes twice a day, three times a day, onto the screen, because the screen never tried to fix me. It never said, you're boring me. It never cried back. You know, I could repeat myself. And so I did it entirely for me, with no idea or instinct or anything that I would ever use it for anybody else. And then the M word came out during my treatment. And I began to be approached by this online menopause community, and I saw how amazing that was. And as time progressed, and I began to see the benefits of people sharing their stories, and that's what other women needed to hear, I began to think, well, maybe I could share my story. And maybe that would help some people. And then I hummed and hawed about it for about 3 months, because the idea of putting my soul out there was terrifying. And because we all have a public persona, whether or not you're in the public eye, that you have a public persona when you go into Tesco. And when I am a doctor, be it a doctor on telly or a doctor in my surgery, I'm very much in that role. And this was going to put myself out there as Philippa the person. And I was very frightened of that. So it took me a long time to come around to it. And then I began to just think, if it makes somebody else feel less alone, because I felt terribly lonely the entire time, and actually still do about lots of it. Really? But if it helps other people feel less alone, then this is worth doing. I was absolutely terrified going on this morning talking about my cancer, and I was terrified to have the book published. But what has come back has been utterly astounding in the responses of people, and I am so very glad that I have done it. However, when my friends and family say that they've got it, I say, thank you very much. You don't need to read it, or we don't need to talk about it. Because it's one thing having complete strangers read the insights of your brain, and it's another thing when it's your mum.
Yes, absolutely. Oh my goodness, I can relate to that. And the first diary entry that's published details the moment of diagnosis. Tell us a little bit about that day.
So it wasn't something, a cancer had never really been mentioned. it wasn't anything that anyone was looking for. Now, I appreciate that my job, essentially, when you walk through my door into my surgery, or I pick up the phone to you, I have the entirety of medicine as a possibility, right? And then you say, oh, my nose hurts. And then I sort of narrow down to ENT, and then I sort of keep going, right? And we're always on the lookout for cancer. And we're always lookout for those red flag symptoms that are going to make us say 2 week wait. And I didn't have any. And so when I had gone to my GP, I had gone with some pelvic pain that sort of started after the birth of my youngest daughter. And I've had 3 cesarean sections. And I had some sort of generalized pain. And they sort of said, well, you know, it's probably scar tissue. And that's what I thought it was. And I was 38, 39. And then it began to get sort of much worse and began to interfere with my life. And so I went back and they said, okay, well, we'll do an ultrasound scan and then we'll send you to a gynecologist. And when I went to see the guy, and Scottish doesn't show up very well on ultrasound scans, I went to see the gynecologist, and I am forever grateful to him because he examined me and he said, well, I think that you're very likely to just be full of scar tissue, because I'd also had my appendix out and I'd had an ectopic pregnancy. I'd had a lot of pelvic surgery. And he said, but I'm a bit worried that your womb might be stuck to your bowel. So we need to have a bowel surgeon involved. So go and see a bowel surgeon first. And I went to see the bowel surgeon. He went, well, yeah, probably it's that. But we should just do a colonoscopy just to check. And I remember I did the bowel prep and I was really cross about it because it's not very pleasant. And I'd had to take time off work and I didn't want to have, you know, to be sedated and whatever else. Yeah. And he walked in to do the consent form and he went, no, do you know, 1 in 10,000 chance we're going to find something. We'll just, you know, you're going to have this other operation and it'll be fine. And so I went into the colonoscopy suite and they pushed the sedation and I lay back to sort of close my eyes and relax and looked up at the screen and there it was. And
you knew, presumably, what you were looking
for. I knew. And it was from that moment on, it was like there was no sedation at all because sort of adrenaline and everything else just fought it. And I looked at the surgeon, and as his eyes came up to meet mine, I thought, oh. And the room, I remember really clearly that the room got quieter and quieter. And someone came with a tissue and someone came to hold my hand. And the kinder that the nurses got, not that they weren't kind before, but the kinder that they got, the more I knew. And we didn't really, no one said the word cancer at that point. And then he said, I'm just going to try and get past it. And it began to really hurt. And he said, I don't need to hurt you. You're going to have a major operation. I don't need to hurt you anymore. And then I thought, oh, you're really about to hurt me, aren't you? And then he gave me my first tattoo because I haven't had a tattoo. And I knew very much that my mother would disapprove of tattoos. You tattoo the mark inside, right? And so the next thought in my head was, I'm going to have to tell my mum I've got a tattoo. She's going to be furious. but, you know, I knew. And then he said, you know, I'm going to meet you back in the room. I'm just going to write my notes and meet you back in the room. And I hadn't even got my husband with me.
I was going to say, you must have just so unprepared, just thinking.
Completely unprepared. And my mum was upstairs sort of waiting to take me home. Yeah. And they went to get her. And she took one look at me and she said, "What's wrong? Did it hurt?" And she got to me before the surgeon did. And I said to her, "I've got cancer." And that, to me, was a moment that was almost as bad as me working it out myself. Because somehow, as a child, and that's what you do when you get ill, you revert to child mode, right? Is that I had to tell my own parent that I had cancer. And she came and she put, I was still on the bed, and she put her arm around me and did not let go. And there were lots of conversations and lots of people came in and they were arranging other scans and things. But she did not let go. And then he came in, the surgeon, and he did what doctors are taught to do, which is you don't want to say to someone, "You've got cancer." You want to say to somebody, "You know, you had a lump in your breast, and you know that you came in and that we were doing some investigations. And, you know, one of the things that we were looking for," and generally at that point, the patient already knows. Mm-hmm. And so they come to the realization themselves, mm-hmm. which you then confirm. And it's slightly gentler than throwing the grenade in the life, right? Yeah. And so he came in and he said, "Well, you know, you came for a test." And I said, "No, let's just say it. I've got cancer. Hi." And he said, "Yes." And I felt the doctor wall descend.
Right.
And I went, "Okay, what's next?" And that doctor wall is, all doctors have it, whether or not they're aware of it, or I think, you know, nurses do, healthcare professionals do, that when we see stuff that's terrible and we see humanity acting terribly and we see awful things all the time. And so you have to have a double wall. And that doesn't mean that you're hard. It means that you protect yourself. Yeah. And we are always thinking, what next? And that's what I did. I put the wall down and I said, what next?
So you gave yourself a wall between yourself and your cancer diagnosis then? As an individual?
Yeah. And when I wrote actually about my cancer, it was always a he. Not because I have anything against men or women or any gender. It was nothing to do with that. When you write a book about pregnancy, you refer to the fetus as he to differentiate from the she as the mother, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what the copy editors always say to do. And I needed to differentiate it from me.
Right.
Because it wasn't me.
Yeah.
I didn't do it on purpose. You know, it wasn't me. It was something that was happening to me inside of me. And I needed to differentiate that from me.
And I was talking to a friend, actually, just as a sideline, who was diagnosed recently with prostate cancer. And he said that the way he frames it and thinks about it is by saying to himself, "My prostate has cancer. My prostate has a tumour. I don't have cancer.
Yeah.
So I need to enable and help my prostate to deal with this and look after my prostate," which kind of removes it, I guess. It puts it one step away. So for you, it was colon cancer, wasn't it?
Yes, bowel cancer, yeah.
Do you know any reason why? I mean, you were fit, young, healthy, you know, 30-something.
Yeah, so my risk at the time was
symptoms. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so I was extraordinarily lucky pickup. And I'm very grateful for that lucky pickup, which sounds like an odd thing to say. I'm grateful that I had cancer. I'm grateful that I had cancer at a time when it could be diagnosed and treated. But I didn't have change in bowel habit, and I didn't have bleeding, and I didn't have, and I didn't have. But what was then found out was that I had a gene that doubles my, I have a gene that doubles my risk of bowel cancer. So I went from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Still unlucky.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about telling your mother and your mother being there and that kind of child-parent relationship. Your own children at the time, yeah. I think, were 4, 7, and 11.
That's
how
right.
How did you go back and explain it to them?
So I spoke to my husband because once I'd had the colonoscopy, they then wanted various other tests that day and I wasn't coming home for hours. And I said to him, "You need to wait for me." And I had a CT colonoscopy next, which was when they essentially put air up your bottom and take a CT scan. And I was getting changed afterwards. And I was naked on the floor of this changing room. And I rang my best friend, who's a child and adolescent psychotherapist. And I said, I need you to put on your, not doctor face, but your professional face and just listen to me for 1 minute, because I'm about to go home and tell the children that I've got bowel cancer. Tell me what to say. She could do it, which was good. But basically, I knew what I had to say. I just needed someone to back me up, which was about being honest. And I have been incredibly honest with my children the whole time. And you can be honest and child age appropriate. So I went home and I said, we were sitting at the top of the stairs, all five of us. And I said, Mummy went to the doctor today and they told her that she has bowel cancer, and cancer is some abnormal, unhealthy cells, like the size of a golf ball, and they need to take it out. And Mummy's going to be in hospital for a week to 10 days, and then she might have to have some medicine. And Mummy's going to be very tired because all her energy is going to be going into looking after her tummy. But the doctors are going to do everything that they can, and Mummy's going to do everything that she can to get better. And the four-year-old said, who's going to take me to school, which is entirely age appropriate. Yes. The seven-year-old came instinctively, his arms came up towards me, and then he recoiled before he got there. And he said, you can't catch cancer, can you? Oh, do you think your hair's going to fall out? It'd be really interesting to see a bald mummy. And the 11-year-old was reading a book, and in the book, the mother had cancer, and he had other questions later. And the whole way through, I was very honest. So when they said the night before surgery, you know, they were very upset. I think more at the thought of the fact that I was going away for what felt like a long period of time, a week to 10 days, and that they weren't necessary. And the surgeon had said to me, they're not going to come and see you for 3 or 4 days. You're not going to be ready. And so I sort of had to prep them. And they said, are you scared, Mummy? And I said, are you scared? And they said, yes. And I said, me too. And they said, what are you scared of? And at that point, for that particular surgery, I wasn't scared I was going to die. I was scared later I was going to die, but at that point I wasn't. I said, I'm scared it's going to hurt, but they're going to give me the medicine to make it better. And I'm scared because I haven't had it before, and I'm scared because of X, Y, and Z. And we cried together. And what that does is means that they aren't alone in it.
Yes,
I can't make it better. I could never make it better. I couldn't make it better for myself. I couldn't make it better for them. But I can be with them in it. And you know, to borrow Glennon Doyle's, we can do hard things. We can do hard things, but it's far easier to do them if we're not on our own.
Yes.
And that's what I tried to give my kids.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I know there'll be many people listening who may not have had cancer, but are supporting a loved one through their diagnosis and treatment right now. What advice would you give them to be that supportive person?
That all feelings are valid, even when they conflict, and that you don't need to fix it because you can't fix it. So when our loved ones are in pain of whatever kind they are in, we want to make it better. That's what we want to do. And so we give solutions and we say, you know, when someone rings and says, I don't want to go to chemo today, you say, you have to, you're strong, you can, we'll get an ice cream or whatever. And actually, what I needed and what I can see from my patients is for someone to go, it's bad today, isn't it? Mm. And, you know, yes, it's hard. You don't have to go and skipping and laughing and jumping. You got to go, but it sucks. And so to listen and not try and fix, which is essentially the same thing as I say for my kids, is that to be there with you in it. And the reason why it's so hard and so hard for us watching our friends, our family, is because it hurts. And you feel a tiny bit of their pain, and that's called countertransference in psychotherapeutic terms, that you feel just the tiniest bit, like when someone's furious and you begin to get annoyed, it's because a tiny bit rubs off on you. And so when we do it with people with cancer or other serious illnesses, our urge is always to fix. I don't need you to fix. I need you to hold my hand. And so that's what I would say to anybody who's trying to support. Listen and say, it sucks, I'm with you, what's going to help? Not try X, Y, and Z.
Do you think there were any advantages for you being a doctor in this situation, or was that a disadvantage? Sort of was ignorance bliss, perhaps, and you were almost too aware of what could happen and what was going to happen?
So I think that there are pluses and negatives. First of all, for me, the hospital is a safe place. And I know for many people it isn't, but for me, a hospital is a place where people are working together to do everything they can to make you better. And I know that because I'm on the other side. I also know that when you are under the surgeon's knife, the hospital could be burning down and their only priority is you. So I felt very safe from that point of view. I also understand medicalese, and that's my language. So that is comforting to me. So those things are good. However, I am, even if I was a lower colorectal surgeon, that still doesn't mean that I am my own doctor. And as I said before, doctors are always taught to think about the next step and the worst case scenario. And for me, turning that off, turning off worst case scenario, turning off what if this doesn't work, what if this doesn't work, was exceptionally difficult. And that in ICU, when things were difficult, when things were going wrong, that to turn off the part of my brain that was going, why is nobody here with this drug, or I'm going to need this, or something else is happening, that has been really hard the whole way. But just as being a doctor affected me as a patient, I do think that being a patient has affected me as a doctor. And that, I think, is the better. And that is the ability to sit in the silence and to hold the hand metaphorically. And I can pinpoint that to one moment in my first ICU stay, and it was in the middle of the night and my heart was doing funny things, and you know, my kidneys weren't happy, and it was not a good place. And the ICU doctor came in and he sat on my bed and he held my hand and he went, pretty shit tonight, isn't it?
Oh my goodness.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And as I said, I'm aware I'm repeating myself, sorry, but that moment was enough because it meant that somebody understood. Mm-hmm. And so that when my patients come in and they say, I'm afraid, or this is happening and this is happening and this is happening, and I say, that sucks, doesn't it? You see their eyes come up to meet you, mm-hmm. that just for a moment that they feel that someone's on their side.
Yeah.
So it works both ways, advantages and disadvantages.
It is absolutely fascinating. I mean, I love the fact that it was written as a diary, because it does really take you through this journey. And of course, you were diagnosed before the pandemic struck, but much of your actual treatment took place during lockdown. What was that like?
I wouldn't recommend dead.
Hope we don't go back there, please God.
So I had my first surgery and chemotherapy before the pandemic ended, and then there was this, I had a stage 2 bowel cancer. There was this hope that at the end of that, which was sort of January, February 2020, that I would be done, and they found more lesions on my scans, and I ended up having surgery in May, so right in the height of the pandemic, in September 2020. And that September was a huge surgery. I was in ICU for 10 days. I was in hospital for 15, entirely on my own.
Yes.
And in May, I came back to homeschooling, you know, and there was all of those things, and without that other support. And I think that when we look back on the pandemic and we look about the things that we did right or did wrong or had to do, but caused other harms potentially. And, you know, and we know about direct and indirect harms. The trauma of being on your own is huge.
Oh, yeah. And the legacy of mental health that the nation and the world has been left with is just, yeah, shocker, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that that's not just for the patient, but also for your family members, that they felt entirely helpless, that, you know, there was literally nothing that they could do.
I mean, to not be able, you know, you talk about the importance of somebody sitting on your bedside and holding your hand, but not, yeah, to be able to have to be in intensive care and not, and so frightened, and having had all that, you know, dreadful trauma and the recurrence of...
So I think that there were definite, now I look back with hindsight, there are some things which I think potentially were useful. So one, technology, as long as you control the technology, is good. Two, I was very clear what I wanted from my friends, which was, I'm sorry if I can't answer the message, but I really would like that every time I pick up my phone, someone sent something. And I asked them to write me letters, because a physical letter is something special that someone's taken the time to write. Yes. And they sent me letters. And so the postman appears in the hospital, and he would appear sort of every day about 2 or 3 o'clock. And that was something I really looked forward to. And I knew that they must have written the first ones before I'd even gone into hospital.
Oh, what a great idea for somebody to say, yes, you know, if you're in extended stay in hospital, please write, please get people to write. So yes, every day you get that visit from the postman.
Yes. So it's like they're visiting. So I think that helped. And I think also there was an opportunity to entirely turn inwards and say, okay, this is what I need to do now in order to survive this and go home. But those things are very firmly outweighed by the trauma of doing it on your own.
Absolutely. And presumably lockdown just making it worse and going back. You said you had to go back to homeschooling.
Yes, so in October, thankfully, I didn't. But in May, I had to go back to, yes, to, it's not just about the homeschooling. It's about the noise and the bustle.
Yes.
And 3 children. And you can say, mummy needs to rest. But it's actually very hard to turn off the mummy head if they're all in the house all the time. Right. Yes. And what you need to heal more than anything is rest. And for me, what I needed was quiet. In ICU, it's not quiet. You're virtually tied to the bed with, you know, both between the catheter and the central line and the 2 drains and the, you know, the epidural and everything else. But everything beeps, and there is no quiet, and sleeping is really difficult.
I was going to say, does it beep all the way through the night when you're trying to sleep?
When things aren't going right, yeah. And even if they sort of turn off the pulse noise, there'll be an alarm when something goes wrong, but sort of when the bag ends or when they need to change something or when this fluid ends, there are beats, and there's, you know, rustling and hustling, and ICU is a noisy place. And I craved silence and some kind of peace, and it's very hard to find that in the ICU, and it's hard to find that when your house is full.
Yes.
But what that also meant was that support from my parents, my siblings, people that ordinarily would have walked to school, walked my kids to school for me, picked them up for me, you know, all of those things, gone to Tesco for me, all of those things, you know, my sisters or my mum would have walked in, taken one look, started clearing up, and, you know, washed the knickers, and I would do the same for them. But they weren't there because they weren't allowed, because we were in whatever stage of restriction that we were in. And so it was incredibly difficult. And I think that for anyone that's done it, or who is still doing it, and I understand why we have to do it, because we have to keep people in hospitals safe. And if they would have given me a cough on top of everything else I had, you know, it would have tipped me over the edge. But it does show you how incredibly resilient you can be. Mm. And when you need to be, because survival instinct will kick in, but that trauma is ongoing and it most definitely needs to be worked through. And I am very open about the fact that I've been in therapy since about 3 months after my diagnosis, and I still am in it now.
Interesting. I'd like to come on to talk about that, but can we just cover off the practicalities of the hospital trip? Because one of the bits that I love about your book is that it does have so many helpful pointers and bits of information at the back of the book. You share, for example, your packing tips for going into hospital. What did you take with you when you were in?
So I learned from the first time. And I remember actually writing that, like the non-maternity edit of the hospital bag, right? Because when you're pregnant, you spend a lot of time thinking about what's supposed to go in that bag. And when you're going in for major surgery, you don't. So for me, little things like having various different toiletry bags and knowing what was in each of them so that I could say, bearing in mind that your ICU nurses are changing shifts every 12 hours and you can't move, to be able to say, my toothbrush is in the red bag and the red bag's on the top left of my big bag. Mm-hmm. And my phone charger is in the blue bag, which is, you know, on the right hand side, right? Make life a little bit easier from that point of view. And then to go soft. Everything that could possibly be soft needs to be soft because everything hurts. So a soft hairband. I've got big, wild, curly hair. I didn't want it in my face, but I also didn't want a hard hair bubble. So soft hairbands, soft hair bubbles, soft non-underwired bras. I knew I wanted to wear a bra, but I also knew that my belly would be hugely swollen. And I went to M&S and I said, I'm not having breast cancer surgery, but I'm having cancer surgery. Can you help? Because I knew that I would feel sort of more like me a little bit if I had a bra on, which sounds funny, but sort of that was part of my thing. And eye mask and earplugs and lip salve, because your lips get dry and I wasn't allowed to eat for ages or drink. And so a list of things like that were really useful. But also I said to everybody, my phone is on silent. You look when you want to look. You don't call. You don't respond to the beck and call of the ping. You're in control over that.
I think that's, you know, it's such good practical advice. And then coming home, similarly, is there anything for people to be aware of, either for themselves coming back or for people who are looking after others coming out of hospital?
A few things. One, I sort of tried to prep a little bit for the freezer. It's very I'm somebody that does find it difficult to ask for help. But my family also know that when I say please help, it means, oh my God, please help. So I asked, and when my kids were unsettled, it was interesting because the first time, you know, within about 20 minutes of me telling various groups, and sort of my local faith group and my kids' schools that I had cancer, there were about six different meal rotas being offered. I'm part of the Jewish community and that's what we do. And so people were offering food, and what my kids wanted was not random people's food or my friends' food. They wanted my food.
Sure.
They wanted to feel that mummy was still looking after them. So I said no to a lot of this food, but I was very sort of specific about saying to my mother-in-law or my mother or my sisters, which I knew that my kids would be happy eating, about things like that. And about planning in rest time, planning in your walk time. And I was very clear to people, because people at the beginning started saying to me, what do you need? I'll do anything that you want. What do you need? I don't know. I don't even know how long it's going to take me to get out of bed today. I don't know how long it's going to take me to be able to walk from my bedroom to the bathroom and brush my teeth, never mind put on any clothes. So I don't know what I need. And what you're trying to do is ask me to give you something so that you feel better that you've done something.
Nice.
And I can't deal with that. And then if you say to me, well, I'd like to come and I'd like to hear about everything that happened in the hospital. Well, okay, but maybe I don't want to talk about that right this second. So I started saying to people, please tell me when you're in Tesco. And I know that you're passing my door on the way home. Mm-hmm. Please tell me when you are in wherever you are. And then people started doing that for me. So if you were to say to me, I'm going to the supermarket, what do you want? I might have said nothing, don't worry. But if you rang me from the supermarket and said, I'm here and I'm passing your door because I'm going to the dentist, you know, up the road or whatever else, so let me, it's going to be no extra hassle. Mm-hmm. That sort of gave me permission to say, this is what I need.
Yes, yes. Interestingly, you talk about therapy. And is that something that as a doctor you had ever considered before?
So I had some therapy when I was suffering with recurrent miscarriage. And all I could think about was getting pregnant, staying pregnant, keeping babies, losing babies. And so I'd had about a 6 month period of cognitive behavioral therapy, which I'd found very helpful, probably about a decade earlier. And obviously I am aware of therapy and I talk about it to my patients all the time and I'm aware of what good it can do. So I was always open to it. I wasn't open in that first week between diagnosis and surgery, when people started saying, oh, you know, this charity will do you psychotherapy or whatever else, because I wasn't there. I was totally in, let's get to the hospital and let's start. Mm-hmm. And it took a little bit of time for me to get out of that mindset into now what. And so I started going to therapy. And in that first session, it was a 15-minute session, I think she said maybe three sentences. And I just literally blurted out stuff that had been happening to me. And therapy has been invaluable for me to process, to have that non-emotional response back. Because as I said, when we love someone and they're sad and they tell you about something that makes them sad, if they're crying, you know, you get upset too. And I was always very aware of the emotional comeback that that my feelings were inducing in other people. And to go somewhere where the other person had no, well, I mean, they obviously did have a feeling, but I didn't get anything back from that.
That's so interesting.
Was hugely helpful and is still hugely helpful. And there is still a way to go. Your body heals, and there is still definitely, I mean, I have lots of symptoms from, you can't remove so much of somebody's bowels and be left with nothing. I had life-changing surgery. But the mind takes a long, long time to heal. And when you are told that you are cancer free, which I have been, it feels a little bit like falling off a cliff as you go from survival mode into living mode, and you haven't been in living mode for a while, and you sort of begin to hope and plan, and you move away from seeing your doctors and nurses sometimes almost every day to 3 months and then 6 months, and how unsafe that all feels. And so there is definitely still work to be done. And right now, I'm actually quite open in saying that some of that work is about going back to the me that was in hospital on her own and holding her hand, because there was no one else to provide that support, but to understand that I could provide that support and working through that trauma.
Well, Philippa, it's just extraordinary. It's so fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing so much so openly. I'm sure that a lot of people, whether they're going through the journey themselves or that they have people close to them going through a similar situation, will find this extremely helpful. And very, very best of luck and best of health going forward. Now, you know, are you able to relax?
No.
Oh, dear.
No.
But you're able to laugh.
Oh, yes. I've been able to laugh the whole way through. But I think, though, what's really important, I function, I exist, I work, I love, I have my family and I do everything that I want to do. It's not quite over in my head or in my body, but, you know, I wanted to write to publish this, because so many of those amazing, amazing, fantastic cancer diaries out there end with the person dying, and they end with an epilogue written by, you know, the partner or the best friend or whoever, and they're heartbreaking. And I wanted to end with the fact that I'm still here, and I'm still here, and I'm living, because that is what the majority of us with cancer are going to do.
Brilliant. Very positive, uplifting note to end on. Philippa, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you on my podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Philippa Kay's book, Doctors Get Cancer Too, is out now. And many thanks again to her for sharing so much so openly here. And speaking of sharing, a couple of shares now from our own wellbeing community here. An email just in from Tammy in Somerset, who says, amongst many things, she's talking about menopause awareness. She says, I would love to be able to get a specialist into work to speak or as part of a coffee morning at home. I'd like to raise money to part funds from specialist one-to-one consultations. I'd like to get books in the staff room. I'd like to make a group to share and talk about the brilliant information that you, Davina, and Dr. Newson are providing. I'd like to warn the 30-somethings of what's to come so they don't feel they're going mad as I did. I'd like for husbands and teenagers to have more information as they are so often at the end of mood swings. That is very true, Tammy. And I think all we can do is push forward. Love all your ideas. So, yeah, let's put that out there as some action points. And this also echoes the sentiments of Sir Rod Stewart, no less, who said last week how menopause classes should be made available for all men so they can learn more about what their wives and girlfriends are having to deal with so as to be more supportive. Brilliant. What do you think? Good idea, yes. Thank you for that, Sir Rod. Who would have thought, eh? Brilliant. Well, lastly, I've just picked up this little comment on the iTunes reviews. You're always very welcome to leave comments and reviews there. This has come from Fab122, who says, I think this is referring to my last Friday Five with Alice Hart Davis when we talked about Linda Evangelista and cosmetic procedures going wrong. And this is what she leaves a comment saying, thank you for sharing such a candid conversation with Alice. It was so fascinating to hear about these invasive techniques. I hadn't heard of some of these tweakments before. I can't say I would ever dabble in that world myself, but it's great to hear about them. As for the HRT update, thank you so much for this. I would be mortified if they took estrogel off the market. For me, it is working beautifully, although I did have a little hiccup with one bottle a few weeks ago. It was a gritty texture. Weird. Thank you again for all your hard work. Really, really appreciate it. Lots of love. Well, thank you very much indeed. Don't forget that if you do have any issues with estrogel, which is the gel form of estrogen made by Bessin's Healthcare, do drop them a line. Let them know about it. It's important that manufacturers are always aware of this kind of thing. But also do please report any adverse side effects or problems with any medical product or procedure or treatment to the MHRA. And you can do that easily on the free MHRA Yellow Card app. And that goes for anything that gives you an adverse reaction. Well, don't forget that you can connect with my team and me across a wide range of channels. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, you name it. There's always lots going on, lots to say, lots to share. So feel free to join in as you choose. Until the next time we speak, have a good weekend and a great week ahead. Go well. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.